Hello, welcome to Olden Village. Today is Thursday, July 30th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening is Mary Boyes. Today's session number is 98-7, and it is titled, Is Christianity Anti-Semitic? Let's listen in.
This session, I must admit I'm a little uncomfortable with the title, but I didn't know how to do it sort of shorthand to get anybody to come, because I wanted to go through some of the history. And, you know, history, particularly for Americans, you know, we're not sometimes so eager about it. And I thought, oh, Lord, 6:20 at night, and I'm going to do the history of Jewish-Christian relations. And I thought both of my friends might come. But at any rate, so I posed the question rather sharply. I'm actually not going to answer it, and I'll let you make your own decisions. But let me just, before I launch full scale into this topic tonight, let me just give a little context, particularly for those of you who are newly arrived or haven't been following this particular set of presentations. I have been concerned for some time about the way in which we Christians talk about our own tradition, our own theology, our own practices, in light of our origins in Judaism. And I've been trying to rework then, rethink how it is we teach about ourselves. So this is primarily a project for other Christians. A couple of people have asked me over the last week, 2 weeks, whether I'm a Jew. And that strikes me as a strange question, because my entire passion really is for how we might think, not my entire passion given my whole life to this project. There are many other things I care about. But that I'm really concerned as an educator in the Christian tradition how it is that we might think through more appropriately and honestly who we are. Now, the question tonight that I have posed is putting it, I suppose, most sharply. That is Christianity anti-Semitic? Note I'm not asking whether Christians are anti-Semites. First of all, I couldn't be the judge of that. I certainly think it's very possible that many Christians are indeed anti-Semites. Many Christians are racist and bigots and so on and so forth. It's not what we would like to claim about Christianity. We have only to look at something like these Christian white supremacist groups. I mean, that's very clear that Christianity among those groups is incredibly anti-Semitic. But I really am not interested tonight. I mean, if someone wants to ask a question or make a comment about one of those groups, that's fine. But I really am not. I'm talking more or less about what we would think of as sort of not just mainstream Protestantism, but mainstream Christian groups, not those on the far right, or I suppose maybe on the far left. But I'm sort of less, maybe I'm less troubled with that, which shows my own bias. So what I would like to do, and I'm mindful that we have just an hour, and it's already late in the day, and I don't want anybody to fall asleep, because on these chairs, that could be the end of you. Your body may never, ever recover. So on this side of the board, I have a very brief outline, and I feel a little guilty already, because, you know, this is one of those things, if you have a momentary daydream, you've just missed an epoch. But I don't. The only way I know to make some presentation about this topic is to use history as a tool. So this will, of course, not be an entirely adequate rendition of history. Nonetheless, it seems to me that our history is important. And one of the things that I have learned from sustained contact with Jews is that Jews know this history. We, for the most part, do not. And I think that I were giving this presentation at the Jewish equivalent of Holden Village, I don't think anybody'd come, because this would be a non-question. The answer would be absolutely yes. However, I want to make some, I will have some qualifiers that I'd like to make about the question. On the right-hand side of the board here, I have a few terms that I'll be using as we go along. There's only one really sort of big term, and that's nice to be able to drop in a conversation. So kind of after the end of the term, you'll be able to use that. So now, this is obviously a big leap, I want to say something about the Reformation, because insofar as of the Lutheran heritage here, this is a very real issue, and I'd like not just to speak about Martin Luther, but what the ELCA has done in 1994 in terms of its statement, a declaration on the part of the ELCA to the Jewish people. I think that's a very important document. So I will try, particularly in the part on the Reformation and modernity, speak a little bit about what the churches are doing today. So I'm going to try not to get lost in the history somewhere, but nonetheless, it's important to look at some of what our ancestors in faith have done. Let me begin, however, with the modern era, and particularly in Washington, D.C. Many of you who have visited our nation's capital have been to the Holocaust Memorial Museum. How many, just out of curiosity, have been to that? That's quite a number. And as you may or may not know, that museum is oversubscribed. The people who planned it and so forth have had no idea they would have as many visitors as it's had. It's actually quite difficult to get a ticket. Admission's free, but you have to have a ticket, and some weeks there just aren't any openings. This is from an article that appeared in the New York Times Magazine in 1995 about a group of school children who were taken by their teachers, I think Sunday school children actually, who were taken by their teachers to visit the museum. And these children had spent an hour in a room or set of rooms called Daniel's Story. Those of you who've been there know this is especially for children, which is a kind of a composite account of a young Jewish boy's experience during the Holocaust. So here's how the dialogue goes. There are names with all of these children, but since they're really irrelevant, I'm just going to say a boy, a girl, and so forth. They didn't pray, a boy declares. But many did pray, I say, I being the journalist here, right to their deaths. Then they weren't believing. Maybe, someone else suggests, maybe they did something wrong and they didn't repent. It's a jealous God, says the boy, quoting Exodus. Terrible. He's jealous because people worship golden calves, idols. And then the journalist adds this. The children recognize the injustice in Daniel's story, but they explain it away by presuming that the Jews were misguided in their faith. As their teacher puts it, quote, I believe that the Jews are God's chosen people. But they don't recognize that Jesus Christ is the Messiah, that he came already. If they had, I think the Lord could have heard their prayers a lot more. In a way, they were praying to a God that they didn't really know. I find this a very disturbing thing to be said after having been at the museum. And it says to me the importance then not simply of encounter with the Shoah or the Holocaust. That's another word I might put up here. Many people today prefer to talk about Shoah rather than Holocaust. Because as you recall from Leviticus, which I know you read every night before sleep, that a Holocaust is a whole burnt offering. It was a kind of sacrifice that was commanded. So it was a good thing in Jewish history. Shoah, on the other hand, which means in Hebrew something like whirlwind of destruction, gets at a little more of what happened. But at any rate, the point, it seems to me, is not for us to think that we can deal with the question of the church's relationship with Jews simply or primarily by study of the Shoah. But I think what we have to do is look at the theological claims that we make about ourselves as Christians, and that we also use as conclusions about what the Jews didn't believe or didn't do, and examine whether we've actually done a fair portrait of Jews and Judaism. So that being sort of my overarching fundamental assumption, then let me give some qualifiers to the original question about whether or not Christianity is anti-Semitic. One thing that I would like to call your attention to is that today there are a number of people who make a distinction that I actually find useful, although like all distinctions, sometimes it's neater in linguistic theory than it is in the messiness of everyday life. And that's the distinction between anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism. This term anti-Semitism comes from the modern period. I think it's 1878 that Wilhelm Kamar coined the expression. And it usually includes, as it's used, although not everybody uses it with exactitude, an economic, social, cultural prejudice against Jews that results in discrimination and so forth. Whereas anti-Judaism, as many people use it, refers to theological notions about Jews that rest on the premise that Judaism has become obsolete because of the coming of Christ. And to make that obsolescence seem a little easier to image, I call upon what someone said a couple of nights ago. The train came, the Jews missed it, and you know we got on the right train, and they missed it, and they're over. And that the Jews sort of fell out of Christian rethinking after the first couple of centuries. Now, the word that I think goes with anti-Judaism, and I think is a very important word, although it's virtually unused in the church, the term is unused, but I think the reality is there a lot, is the term supersessionism. You think of that is that the church supersedes or replaces Judaism. And that is, for me, the basis of anti-Judaism. We have, as a people, replaced the Jewish people. One of the images of this that you may have seen in many of the cathedrals in Europe are the two images of the synagogue and the church, synagoga and ecclesia. I think most visibly in the cathedral in Strasbourg, but in many other places as well. And in that image, you have these two women figures. Synagoga is, I mean, there are variant ways of doing it, but in most of them, she's bent over, the crown has fallen from her head, the staff has fallen out of her hand. She is defeated. And next to her stands the beautiful, triumphant figure of the church. She has triumphed. And I don't know the actual count of how many figures of ecclesia and synagoga there are, but it was one of the staples of medieval art. And it is, for me, the symbol par excellence of supersessionism. That Judaism has been defeated, that the victory of Christ is the victory of the church, and by extension, it's the victory over Judaism. Now, where does this, before I start to trace where some of this comes from, let me just make a couple of qualifiers so that when we use this term anti-Semitic, we're a little more careful, or even the term anti-Jewish. One of the things that we'll look at tonight, very briefly, however, will be some of the legislation that happens in the church. If you've done much study about the Shoah, for instance, read the book of Raoul Hilberg, he sets up a chart in which he parallels all of the legislation of the church, canonical legislation about how Christians relate with Jews, with legislation passed by the Nazis. The problem with that, it seems to me, is that the legislation that comes basically starting in the 4th century and continuing on through the High Middle Ages was, especially in the early days, regional, local. So, you know, a particular region or a particular small area might make a certain regulation, but that didn't apply everywhere. And there were some places at some times where Jews were flourishing in their relationship with Christians. At the same time, maybe 1,000 miles away, it was a very difficult and different situation. So it's very difficult to generalize about this. Now, we're talking largely about Jews in Europe, Jews in the West. And one of the things that's frequently heard today is, well, this is a problem for Euro-Americans. Well, it is a problem historically that has come from Europe and certainly has come to our shores. But it does not seem to me to be a limited problem, because the heritage of anti-Judaism, though it may have come to us primarily from the church in the West and primarily from the church in Europe, is a legacy that all Christians today bear. I recently read a paper from a scholar who grew up in Vietnam and now teaches in Washington, D.C., and he traces anti-Judaism in Asian liberation theologies. That this, you know, that insofar as theology has certain common sources, this is now, I don't know if this is a very good metaphor, but I just read about new viruses that your computer can get. And there is a way in which I think analogously, anti-Judaism has been a kind of virus in Christianity, and it can infect all places in which Christianity is taught. A number of years ago, I had a young student from Japan who had become a Christian in her 20s and would have had no reason to have learned any anti, she didn't know any Jews, but the way Christianity had been passed on to her was filled with some of the same old things that many of us have grown up with. So the other thing I'd like to say as a qualifier is that a lot of what we know about the history of relations between Jews and Christians is, of course, history about, as in many cases, history about wars and decrees and so forth, the history of the people who made it. Now, if we had better sources to do more adequate social histories, to get at, how ordinary people lived, a number of historians point out that even in some of the very worst times in relations between Christians and Jews, or between Christianity and Judaism as institutions, that there would be many villages where Christians and Jews got along as neighbors without any major difficulty. So that we have to be, again, we have to be very careful how we generalize. All right, let me just say a word then about the early church. And I'll stop after this just to give some time for comments and questions. And if at any point you need to stand up because your body is telling you that this chair has gotten to you, feel free. I won't take it as an editorial or anything like that. When I look at the early church, it seems to me that there are two images that are quite helpful for understanding what's happening in the relationship. The first and the earlier of the two images is that of siblings or a sibling rivalry. I've been playing around lately with perhaps it's not just a sibling rivalry, but one of fraternal twins. That Judaism and Christianity are both born. I once did some more scientific investigation about this, and I sometimes wonder whether my metaphor works or not. But that there is this separation, and as the they're not identical twins. They don't look alike, but they were born in the same womb. One of the ways of thinking about it, instead of saying, well, Christianity just came from Judaism, is to think that there were many varieties of Judaism in the first century. Christianity was, before it became called Christianity, believers in Jesus, was one variety, and another variety, which became now what we know as Judaism, is that associated with the Pharisees and probably with the rabbis. The link between the Pharisees and the rabbis is not an exact one, but let's call it close enough for tonight. And that as this starts, it is the relationship of rivals. It's a family argument. It's an argument, but it's within the family. It's an argument about, well, what is the right way to read Torah? What is the right way to read events in the light of Torah? And as arguments go, it gets a little heated at times, and it's not always done fair and square. But then most of us, when we argue, tend to pull out a few things from our repertoire, then we're not always, well, probably you are, but other people that you know may not be entirely fair. So a lot of this surfaces in the New Testament. It surfaces particularly in the Gospels of Matthew and John, and to a certain extent in the Acts of the Apostles. And I'll say a little bit more about the Acts of the Apostles tomorrow when I talk about liturgy and prayer. Now, it seems to me that when you begin to get into the second century, and say, let's talk basically second to fifth century here, things develop a little differently. There is more differentiation. There is not yet, I think, a firm separation between Christianity and Judaism, but the differentiation, there's no doubt that the various communities have started to go along different roads. As I tried to say to those of you who were here yesterday, or Tuesday, or whenever the last session was, who knows, 6 years ago when we all came to Holden, that we cannot point to a single time, a single point in time, when Christianity and Judaism became separate. We can look at certain issues or practices that divided them, certain doctrinal things that are made at the official level, but again, how ordinary people in rural villages might have regarded one another is quite something else again. But the word rival is very interesting because it comes from the Latin rivus, meaning across the stream. And I think that it's a helpful metaphor because if you think of Christians and Jews, as it were, sitting across the stream from one another, Christianity does not become the official religion of the Roman Empire until quite late, not until 390 or so. So Christianity is still, it's not even a licit religion until 313. It's the minority. Jews are much the majority. And especially as you get into the late 2nd century and into the 3rd and 4th century, some of the early Christian teachers are, they are apologists for the faith, which I understand is a good thing, an apologia pro vita sua, speaking about who you are, your identity. Unfortunately, a lot of that was done in the early days as a kind of oppositional identity. And among the most famous is an extraordinary preacher by the name of Melito, who was the bishop of Sardis in Asia Minor. And we had read about him before in Eusebius, but it was not until the 1940s that this particular homily was found. It's a homily on the past, or on the on Easter, on the Christian Passover. And I would very much, I was very tempted to just bring the whole text, but I also knew that we would never get out of it. It's an extraordinary piece of writing. It's not the sermonic style that could be used today. I mean, it definitely is an earlier form of rhetoric, but it is just a beautiful way of teaching Jesus in light of the figures of the Old Testament. I don't think it's an adequate way, but it's just as a piece of rhetoric, it's extraordinary. And one of the things that Melito does, he connects Jesus with all the figures of the Old Testament. And then he begins to move into the what happens to Jesus in his death and resurrection. And he reaches the climax, and I'm just going to read this one paragraph because it's a fairly infamous paragraph. I am ashamed to say and compelled to speak. Just the one paragraph I read, you can listen for his care with language. Who was it? He's asking, I should tell you the question. Who has been killed? Who is the killer? It is a heavy thing to say and a most fearful thing to refrain from saying. But listen, as you tremble in the face of him on whose account the earth trembled, he who hung the earth in place is hanged. He who fixed the heavens in place is fixed in place. He who made all things fast is made fast on a tree. The master is insulted. God is murdered. The king of Israel is destroyed by an Israelite hand. Now that line, God is murdered, is the beginning of the famous or infamous charge of deicide. That is, because Jesus is God, the Jews have killed God. And it's not then until the late 2nd century, Melito's about 190 or so, that this charge, this is not a charge of the New Testament, this is a charge from a later period, but it's had a very long-lasting effect. Many Jews were killed because of this accusation. Now, I don't think Melito of Sardis was an anti-Semite. I think he is trying to stir his congregation to commitment in Christ, and there's no better way to form fervor and zeal than to stir up people's identity over against. I used to be a coach. I know how to do that, right? You know, although I just read in the New York Times, I just read this extraordinary piece about how Little League is becoming so dangerous to umpires because parents are attacking umpires. I mean, it really is. It is a bit sobering to think of this. So, Melito of Sardis, we know a little bit more now about his context. They discovered in archaeological digs at Sardis that there was this huge complex that Jews used as a synagogue, as an assembly hall, as a community center, and so forth, and that the Jews of Sardis would have been quite numerous and prosperous. And here's Melito with his little congregation of people who belong to an illicit religion, and he is trying to justify the ways of this of Christianity over against not only the pagans, but also Jews and Judaism. So I think it's very important that we not impugn this title, anti-Semite, to people of an earlier age. Had Melito had any idea that this charge would have taken on the life that it did, I believe that we would have had a very different sermon. I'm not justifying what he said, but I also think that it's unfair to go after some of these people in history in light of what's happened in 2,000 years of Christianity. Now, another person who formulates something that is very, very important comes relatively late, around 430, Augustine, and he has this, I guess you could call it a sort of a two-pronged theory. And this lasts in the church in some circles, in some official circles, up and through the 20th century. And it's this, that while the Jews have done a terrible thing, they should not be killed. They should not be victimized. But they should be forever wandering the earth. They are a cursed people. And they are assigned, as it were, by God to wander the earth as witnesses to the mistake that they made and to the truth of Christianity.
Cain.
Pardon?
As Cain.
Cain.
In Genesis.
Cain.
Oh, it's Cain. Cain. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Yes. Right. Sorry. Sorry. In fact, this is his. He uses that Cain and Abel story. And this is the reply to Faustus the Manichaean. Yes. Yes. Thank you. And this is not a central thing in Augustine. I mean, Augustine has a great deal to say about many other things, so I'm not trying. But so again, I don't know that it's so much a problem just with Augustine as with the fact when we get to the Middle Ages, you will see what happens to that particular theory. Okay, I said I would stop just for a breath and see if there are questions or comments thus far. We've now made it to the Middle Ages, so that's not a bad accomplishment for only, half an hour. Yes.
Well, if you say that the church was not actually formalized until the 4th century, and
it doesn't become the official religion of the Roman Empire until 490.
Okay.
390. What did I say? 490. 390.
It's not really recognized until 312 or so.
Well, in 313, you have the Edict of Milan, which grants tolerance to all religions, so thereby Christianity becomes licit. And then that's under Constantine. And
but
then several.
Considering that it was just a branch of Judaism.
Can everybody hear his question?
At the time of Mulatto, is not he saying that we kill?
No. Well, thank you. This is helpful. This is what's very confusing, because when we think of Christianity and Judaism today, we think of two separate religious families. But it was a lot messier for the first 4 or 5 centuries, okay? So, it seems clear that in Melito's community, he sees them as very separate. And certainly Augustine does as well. But I do want to point out that people have found evidence from, say, small rural villages in Syria that villagers who might not have had access to a famous teacher like the Bishop of Sardis still thought of themselves as believers in Jesus who also went to the synagogue and, you know, most people in the churches don't spend a great deal of time thinking about theological differentiation. Do you think that's I don't mean to say, well, people don't know whether they're Lutherans or Presbyterians or Methodists. I mean, they know. But it is not something people worry a great deal about. Religious leaders do. That's what they get paid for.
I would like to ask another question. It's evident that the Roman Empire killed Jesus. It with the Romans. It was according to Roman law, and everything which was done was according to that law and that imperium. How come that so soon, instead of blaming the real killer, the Jews were blamed?
That's a very important question, and this is where I dealt with some of this last night, and here I am trying to move on through the church history, so this is very important to clarify. Jesus was killed under the rule of Pontius Pilate, who was the governor of Judea appointed by Rome. We don't have enough historical data to say this with exactitude, but or with surety, but that it is very likely that Jews would not have had the power of capital punishment under the Roman Empire. I mean, after all, Romans were in charge. That there was collusion with Jewish leaders, probably from the high priesthood, also seems very likely. But the high priest was also appointed by Pontius Pilate, so there was already collusion at that level. So the most historically accurate thing that we could say is that Jesus is crucified under Pontius Pilate with the collusion of some Jewish leaders, probably the high priesthood, the institution of the high priesthood, and all of the court that's involved with that. But when the New Testament texts are being written, the leaders or the writers or the communities that from which these texts come are also mindful that they are trying to teach and preach Jesus of Nazareth still in the Roman Empire, and their leader has been killed by the Romans, and so it is in their self-interest to play down Roman culpability and play up Jewish culpability. And the later you get toward the end of the first century, the more that's the case, so that in John's Gospel, it's clearest of all, the Jews collectively kill Jesus. So when Melito comes up with deicide in the 190s or so, he hasn't just invented this whole cloth, it's already in the tradition. Again, I don't think the New Testament writers they didn't have any idea that this would become a source of Christian persecution of Jews later on. So first you have the New Testament teaching that the Jews killed Jesus. Then you have that Jesus is God, therefore the Jews have killed God. And then when you get to Augustine, the Jews are people who are cursed and they must forever wander, but they must not be killed. Okay? This is a heavy topic, and I must say it is supposed to be summertime, and this is my vacation. So let's take a little 30-second stand-up break and honor the fact we have bodies, and then we'll come back.
What do you do when you sleep?
Well, this is a little break.
Yeah,
again, which we talked about.
Yeah.
If somebody open that back door, we might get a little more ventilation.
I thought you had, so.
Yeah. In the Middle Ages, which covers a great deal of territory, starting from pretty much the 5th century through, the 14th century. And again, these are artificial designations, but just to give it a little a title to help us all. There are two things that I'd like to talk about: church policy and racial demarcation. I want to talk about the racial demarcation because this will reappear in the Nazis. I'm not saying this was the source of it, but this is the source in terms of Christian history. In the Middle Ages, in the early part of the Middle Ages, you have a number of these local church councils, as I mentioned, who pass various laws restricting social interaction between Christians and Jews. You can see that the church, which has now become not only illicit religion and the official religion, is still insecure. And so it passes legislation. Again, these are not general things, but a particular part of France will declare that that Christians cannot marry Jews. Another place in Spain will declare that Jews and Christians can't eat together. By the way, I don't know that these have any effect. I mean, just because a decree comes forth doesn't mean that people all say yes, absolutely. Jews were forbidden in some other areas to hold public office. Jews were forbidden to own Christian slaves. One of the more infamous legislations was that Jews were forbidden in one area to appear in public during Easter week. Now, in the 12th century, I want to talk for a minute about 12th, 13th, 14th centuries. You have the beginnings of what might be sort of official church policy, everything before the local, regional, and so forth. And I have to talk about, it's very embarrassing as a Catholic to have to talk about this, papal bulls. Now, it tempts me to use that term. Very tempting. But I won't give in to temptation. I should tell you that in Latin, bulla means a seal. That's why they're called papal bulls. At least originally, that's why they were. Okay. Sometimes I forget I'm on tape, but at any rate. I have to look at my notes because I have no memory for figures whatsoever. Between the 1100s and the 1400s, some 21 different popes issued a bull that began with these Latin words, even as the Jews, sicut judaeis. And I just want to read you little snatches of this, because this was a very important document. This was sent to whatever region was having violent outbreaks against the Jews. The popes sent these as a way of quelling the disturbance. But what you see is Augustine's two-pronged theory at work. Now, this is probably the first time in the history of Holden Village that a papal bull has been proclaimed aloud. But then we also played bingo today, so. Which is the real Catholic Church. Just teasing. Turn the tape off. All right. Just this first sentence is such a clue. Even as the Jews ought not have the freedom to dare do in their synagogue more than the law permits them, so ought they not suffer curtailment of those privileges which have been conceded to them. This is why, although they prefer to persist in their obstinacy rather than acknowledge the words of the prophets, they're using these same texts, by the way, against women now. Oh, no. persisting in our obstinacy. And they persist in their obstinacy about the eternal secrets of their own scriptures. This is a hidden critique of the Talmud. Thus arriving at an understanding of Christianity and salvation. Nevertheless, in view of the fact that they have begged for our protection and aid, which they did because the church was very powerful then, and in accordance with the clemency which our with Christian piety imposes upon us, we grant them their petition and offer them the shield of protection. Do you see how that's giving with one hand and taking with the other? It reminds me of one person I knew who was a bit of a airhead. And she once said to somebody in my presence, you know, you're really much nicer than people say you are. Oh. And this strikes me as a kind of an ecclesial doublespeak like this, that, well, even though you persist in your obduracy and obstinacy, here I guess it is, and even though you don't acknowledge the words of the prophets and so forth, you know, still we will grant you the shield of protection, and then it goes on, we decree that no Christian shall use violence to force them into baptism. No one should wound their persons or kill them or rob them of money. Furthermore, while they celebrate their festivals, no one shall disturb them in any way by means of sticks and stones, nor exact forced service from any of them other than such as they have been accustomed to perform from ancient times. We decree no one shall dare to desecrate or reduce a Jewish cemetery, or with the object of extorting money, exhume bodies there interred. Gives you a little hint of what was going on, doesn't it? So now, in the 12th and 13th centuries alone, this papal bull was promulgated sent some 16 times. So it's a very clear indication that there were outbreaks of violence all over, and that while these bulls, I suppose they gave the official church I guess they cleared the official church of being anti-Jewish in one sense, or anti-Semitic maybe at this point. What they really show is that Augustine has had a very long-lasting effect. They are wrong. They shouldn't be killed. They shouldn't be harmed. But they really are not only wrong, they're cursed, although it doesn't say that explicitly in the bulls. Now, the second thing that happens in the 14th and 15th century, and again, the time is at a limit, but in Spain, Jews had lived together in Spain in great harmony during the 400 years of Muslim rule. And even after the Reconquista, when the when Christians came into ascendancy again, there was some general harmony. But Jews again had become quite prominent, very educated, and so forth. And violence broke out, and some very terrible things happened on the Iberian Peninsula between Christians and Jews. We all know about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain in 1492, and then about 5 years later or so from Portugal. But the most disturbing thing that happens in the Iberian Peninsula is that a number of Jews had become Christians under duress. You know, I mean, it's a very practical problem. Do you want to be baptized or die? And a number had chosen to live. And some of the so-called old Christians resented the Jews, the conversos, those who had converted. And so over the years, what happened was an incredible concern with purity of blood. Only old Christians had the purity of blood. I was horrified and fascinated to read a history of the Jesuits. The Society of Jesus began this period in Spain. And Ignatius of Loyola himself went against the archbishop, one of the archbishops, and would not permit the purity of blood to infect, as it were, the Jesuits. Jews who had become Christians could become Jesuits. But that was overturned not too long after Ignatius's death. And up until 1946, someone who had converted from Judaism could not become a Jesuit. It's sort of unbelievable to me that this is the case. They did modify it somewhere along the line that if you could show you had at least five generations, then you could. Yeah, it's not much of a solution, but now, so then, when the Nazis begin their legislation to demarcate Aryans from non-Aryans, you can see that there's already some history of this in the church itself. So I just wanted to point that out. Now again, mindful that time is moving along, let me speak very briefly about the Reformation, since I'm probably on dangerous ground anyway. You always wanted to hear the full truth about the Reformation. You probably know, and this is probably very familiar history to you, but again, just to kind of, that some people make a distinction between sort of the early Luther, who writes in 1523 an essay on that Jesus Christ was born a Jew, and then just 20 some years later, 1543, on the Jews and their lies.
Yeah.
And I just have to find the right page of notes because I wouldn't want to misquote to this group. he speaks of this damned, rejected race of Jews who should be dealt with by, quote, severe mercy. That is, their synagogues should be set afire, their homes destroyed, their prayer books taken away, rabbis forbidden to teach, their passports revoked, and money lending prohibited. And many people have tried to get at, what happened between 1523 and 1543. Did the early Luther have a strong sense that the reform movement that he led would be so persuasive that the Jews would come to Christ, and then by 43 he is totally disillusioned? That's one theory that's around. I've also read, this actually seems to be fairly reasonable, a critique that says, really, Luther was consistent. He was against anything that was a religion of works righteousness. And the papists and the Jews were the prime example. The Jews, just as the Catholics, were a living embodiment of a legalistic religion. Now, when I was researching some of this material, I found on the web a hymn from the Lutheran book that was cited as an anti-Jewish text. I'm not going to sing it for you, for which you should thank God. And I'm not going to make anybody else. It's number 287, if you'd like to look it up yourself later on. Not at Vespers, that would be cheating. And I thought, when I read it, that this is indeed a true anti-Jewish text. I mean, we have a lot, I mean, you know, this is not unknown in the history of Christianity. Until I happened to talk with Pastor John Stendahl, who has a parish in Newton Center in the Boston area, the son of Christian Stendahl. And he says, no, this was really an anti-Catholic hymn. So I sing it regularly. You're all dying to know what it is. I asked Paul Rohde whether this is sung much, and he says in his experience it's a familiar tune, but these particular lyrics aren't used much. But anyway, salvation unto us has come by God's free grace and favor. Anybody in here? Some people? Okay, good. Good works cannot avert our doom. They help and save us never. Nice didactic lyrics, don't you think? Faith looks to Jesus Christ alone, who did for all the world atone. He is our mediator. No problem so much with that first verse, but listen to the second. Theirs was a false, misleading dream, who thought God's law was given that sinners might themselves redeem. And by their works gain heaven. The law is but a mirror bright to bring the inbred sin to light that lurks within our nature. And yet the law fulfilled must be, or we were lost forever. Therefore God sent his Son, that he might us from death deliver. He all the law for us fulfilled, and thus his Father's anger stilled, which over us impended. The faith clings to Jesus' cross alone. But at any rate, the notion of law there is not a very, full-bodied one. And any time, of course, that you are making a critique of legalism, it generally has to do with, at least in my mind, with Pharisees and hypocrisy and all this kind of thing. But I realized in the throes, this is attributed to someone in, I think it's 1441.
No.
1551.
This is
Luther's
text.
Well, it's not attributed to Luther himself. It's to Paul Spertus. Anyway. But the point being that for Luther, works righteousness, legalism, was the problem, and Catholics and Jews were sort of equally under that particular charge. Now, because the time is drawing on, let me just call to your attention what, in the modern era, Christians are trying to do to take a long, hard look at this history. And let me start with a statement from the ELCA in 1994. There's a statement, I think, that comes out a year later from the Canadian Lutherans. In the spirit of that truth-telling, we who bear his name and heritage must with pain acknowledge also Luther's anti-Judaic diatribes and violent recommendations of his later writings against the Jews. We particularly deplore the appropriation of Luther's words by modern anti-Semites for the teaching of hatred toward Judaism or toward the Jewish people in our day. Grieving the complicity of our own tradition within this history of hatred, moreover, we express our urgent desire to live out our faith in Jesus Christ with love and respect for the Jewish people. Now, I submit to you that this very moving statement does not mean a whole lot unless you know the history, unless you really are prepared to deal with. And I don't just mean the history of Luther. I mean, he is simply the inheritor of a legacy of anti-Judaism that has sullied the Christian church. And many Christian churches today have written documents try to express the repentance, the grief, the desire to educate differently, and so forth. And at least in my experience, most people have not a clue about these statements. I mean, they're written by, you know, certain groups and disseminated, but because we don't know our own history, I don't know, we're busy about many other things, and there seem to be other more pressing justice issues, it doesn't seem that this is making a lot of impact in the church. Now let me just say a very brief word about the Shoah and then use the rest of the time for comments and questions. It's most inadequate to just, I mean, I can only say just a few words about this really unspeakable event of our time. I do not think that the anti-Jewish tradition in Christianity is alone responsible for the Shoah. It might be called the necessary but insufficient cause. There's no doubt that Christian churches bear complicity in it, not simply during the Shoah itself, during the extermination, but also in the way that what has been called this teaching that comes out of Leto, Sardis, and Augustine, and involves the Epistle of Barnabas, some of the teaching of Cyril, of Cyrus. Called the writings against the Jews, or in the words of a modern Jewish historian, the church's teaching of contempt for the Jews. This, by the way, this phrase, teaching of contempt, by Jules Isaac, a French historian, was very influential on Pope John the 23rd. He had developed a personal friendship with him, and he is one of the reasons that the Second Vatican Council in 1965 published what has become a watershed document of the history of Christian-Jewish relations, although it is itself an exceedingly modest statement. It's just the beginnings of a breakthrough. There was much happening in Europe in the 1800s and 1900s that leads to an outbreak of nationalism and so forth, the whole fervor. And in the presence of two Germans, I will not recite all of what I know, very modest knowledge of German history. But there is no doubt that the church is complicitous in the Shoah. You know, and again, there are thankfully witnesses who opposed the regime of the Nazis, all too few. Dietrich Bonhoeffer is one of the most famous, although it's interesting, Bonhoeffer's theology was still fairly anti-Jewish. But he had a very, very strong sense of the inhumanity of the Nazi regime, and teaching as I do at Union Theological Seminary, where Bonhoeffer made his decision to return to Germany. I never go in our famous Bonhoeffer room, which is where we have endless faculty meetings, without being very acutely conscious of this is where a man made a momentous decision of witness and resistance, mysticism and resistance. One of the things that seems to be happening in the churches today is finally more honesty about what the legacy of the church has contributed, not simply to the Shoah, but the way it has really harmed the Jewish people over the years. And some of you may know that the Vatican published a document, a very controversial document in March called We Remember. It's been much criticized. It's actually a fairly tepid document in some respects. But one of the things that sent me doing was looking back at other documents written. And I thought it might be appropriate to read, as sort of my closing line tonight, a statement from the Catholic bishops of France in 1997. It is, Catholic documents are not always famous for their honest, for their sort of honesty about the failings of the church. I don't know that any family, any tradition is really totally honest either. They acknowledge that it's a well-proven fact that for centuries an anti-Jewish tradition stamped its mark in differing ways on Christian doctrine and teaching in theology, apologetics, preaching, and liturgy. This line: it was on such ground that the venomous plant of hatred for the Jews was able to flourish. Now that's a pretty damning statement. In our liturgy, in our theology, in our apologetics, and so forth, we had this anti-Jewish tradition. And then I'd just like to read you this one paragraph they have about the institutional church during the Nazi regime. And this is made as a confession. The hierarchy saw the protection of its own faithful as its first priority. It was a retreat into a narrow vision of the church's mission, compounded by a lack of appreciation for the immense global tragedy that was being played out. For the most part, those in authority in the church caught up in a loyalty and docility which went far beyond the obedience traditionally accorded civil authorities, remained stuck in conformity, prudence, and abstention. Ecclesiastical interests took priority over the demands of conscience, and we must ask why. That's, if you know church rhetoric, you don't find that too often. So let me just end with time for questions and comments. Bill?
You began with the Holocaust Museum and David Drum. A year ago, I was there along with my wife and son, visiting two Jewish friends and their children. And we went to the museum, and their 15-year-old took our son to see a movie, which I think is probably the most profound movie in terms of some educational experience I've ever seen. In terms of the rise, and they didn't say anti-Judaism, but anti-Semitism. And the reason Michael took Aaron to see the movie was because of the extreme attention that they paid to Luther. Mm. But then at the very end of that film, there's the tagline that in what you just read, in 1994, the Evangelical Lutheran Church repudiated. And I asked if that film is available for loan, for churches, and the answer was no.
Is that the film at the Holocaust Museum itself?
At the museum.
Yeah.
Christian anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And, which was a disappointment to me, because our son certainly learned a lot about himself and his church, but it was the Holocaust Museum's way of explaining what you've just done. The complicity, and indeed some of the early leanings of the church.
I also tried to get a copy of that film, so I know a little bit more about it. They have been, they are under severe criticism from some Christian groups. And you know, that's a publicly funded museum, so this is a political hot potato.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's about 20 minutes, or
yeah.
I mean, it's a relatively short film. So, I mean, what I irresponsibly put together in an hour, they do in 20 minutes with many fewer words but much more visuals, and I think it's a very fine film. I mean, one could always, you know, you always could argue about, well, this could be nuanced this way or that way. But there are some right-wing Christians who are after them, and so they're being much more careful than one would want them to be.
Explain that a little more. What the museum's reason for not releasing the film?
Well, there are some Christians who just do not want to admit any complicity on the part of the church during the Holocaust, and they don't. And there are some Christians who believe that, insofar as you proclaim the lordship of Jesus and so forth, that the Jews are simply wrong, and that this is not about anti-Judaism, but about the fact that the Jews are wrong. I know a few names and so forth, and I don't really feel free to say too much more, you know, about it. Yes.
I am a Holocaust scholar, and I'd just like to point out...
Well, I'm glad I didn't know this at the beginning. I
was
going to
work. I would just like to point out that a very, very fruitful place of dialogue between Christian and Jewish theologians is happening in this country on a yearly basis. It is the conference started 28 years ago by Franklin Littell and Hubert Mock, the yearly conference on the Holocaust and the churches. I've been participating at this conference, giving papers for the last several years, and have found many theologians, Christian theologians, Lutheran theologians. I'm Catholic, and an increasing number of Catholic theologians. And I just want to point out that first of all, thank you for your talk, but that there is a very, very fruitful dialogue going on. The problem is how do we take the dialogue that's happening at these scholarly conferences and bring it to this kind of milieu, and thank you for doing it.
Yes. I went to a wonderful conference at Notre Dame with Christian Jewish scholars from all over. But my concern always is academicians are talking to each other about this, and so are the theologians.
Yes.
You know, so that how can we make this something that the people, and how do you do this in such a way that we don't just sort of throw guilt and shame on Christians? Because I don't think, just knowing how terrible the church was in an era does not make us change. So how can this history be empowering? There's a marvelous curriculum project called Facing History in Ourselves that maybe some of your children are using in school that I think is one of the most promising things. If we could have children learn about this in a way that helps us live in a pluralistic society and raise questions about how we talk about ourselves also involves how we think about other people. So yes, in the back.
Just say for Lutherans, there is an institution associated with Muhlenberg College in Pennsylvania called the Center or Institute for Jewish Christians Understanding. And one of the things that I used to be on the board of that for a couple years, and one of the things that they do in a practical kind of way is, they do a lot of their work in the Allentown area in Pennsylvania and do a lot of local work, but they also, run like workshops for pastors on dealing with Lenten texts. There's so much when you read, the Passion of St. John on Good Friday. There's a lot of interesting stuff out there about what you can do about, that every other word is the Jews, and in fact the inclusive language lectionary that our church has published. It has been some changes in that St. John Passion narrative, but one of the things that they do is run a workshop, and I know it's not for people from around here, but that's the kind of model of helping people that are in leadership and teaching and preaching roles in the church.
There are a number of institutes that have been started under Christian auspices, and I should also, it might be of interest to you to know that there's a group of Christians who are interested in the study of Judaism, who meet, ecumenical group, Protestants and Catholics, who meet together twice a year to give papers and study, and the people from Muhlenberg are in that. And so we, we're all, but we're talking to one another so we can think more carefully ourselves, but the more important dialogue is out with the people, and how you actually get to people who have responsibilities for teaching and preaching is my chief concern. And it's a very
texts themselves. You read on Sundays or
that's right.
During Lent.
We're going to talk about that's exactly what we're going to talk about tomorrow. Thank you for helping me to advertise. Thank you very much for your. Yes.
I was going to say. The LCA is just coming out with a document to outline the process, for a Jewish group, Lutheran organizations. It's a rough draft stage, but will be part of the conversation for others, for pastors here. That's coming out.
Wonderful. I'd be happy if I ever could see a copy. One more question.
Is the problem basically that is individual education, or is there also institutional anti-Semitic, institutionalized anti-Semitism still in our churches in America?
Well, I don't think that would be mine to answer. I think that would be yours to answer as you look at your colleagues and so forth. And there's a lot we didn't, this is such a huge topic because it also involves the Middle East and how we respond to Israel. And, there are Lutheran institutions there. I lived at Tantour for 6 months, and I got a pretty good understanding of some of that. So it's a very complex thing. And that's why I said at the beginning, I'm not going to answer the question. But it's very clear to me that the church has a long and very shameful history of anti-Judaism. So on that note, it's more than time for Vespers. Thank you for your attention. You've been fabulous.